Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellis, and with us this week is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. I'm glad to be here again, as usual. I'm glad to be here with you and also with Spencer. Hi, Spencer. How you doing?
Hey, everyone. Great to be here.
So, what's our topic for today?
I think for our topic today, is something that we mentioned in the previous podcast is that we wanted to do a show on is what we would do if we were given the opportunity to actually write Tarmogoyf Gideon. Not necessarily what we think actually will happen, but what we would do if we were given the opportunity, what we would like to see happen, whether or not we think it actually will.
Yeah, and I think that's good. I think there should be an element of what do we think is going to happen at Tarmogoyf Gideon. What are our predictions, even though it may not be what
we
wanted?
I think we can start with each of us kind of explaining how we would write it, and then near the end we can go into what we think will actually be written.
Yeah, because if I actually knew, I mean, if I actually had a really great idea, I'd be an author, like Brandon. But it's really hard for me to come up with these original, amazingly original thoughts about it. So even basing it on all that we already know, I think it's going to be kind of a tough call to figure out what's going to happen. I mean, as we know, we as fans, all of us and all of the other, you know, readers and listeners, we don't always have the highest accuracy at trying to figure out what Robert Jordan or now Brandon Sanderson is actually going to do with the plot and the characters. I mean, there are a lot of people that are really right, and there are a lot of times we're all massively wrong. So this could be a lot of fun. I don't know if it will be very productive, but we'll sure have fun with it.
Yeah.
Well, not to mention the fact that we're going to have essentially a book interspacing our predictions and the current leave-off point in the series.
That's right. We've got two more books to get through, but it's hard to believe that it's actually within sight that we're getting the next book. I mean, we just had The Gathering Storm. It feels like just mere months, well, it was mere months ago, but I mean, it just seems so new and recent. And now, you know, here in another, what, 7 months, 6 months, we're going to have hopefully the next one. And I know I say hopefully because obviously they can't keep to a 100% perfect timeline all the time, but knowing Brandon's track record at getting stuff done and his prodigious ability to get these massive amounts of work done on schedule, I think it's going to be pretty close to being on time. And that, God rest his soul, and no offense meant to Robert Jordan, whom I love and esteem dearly, but that's something that we never could count on with RJ. It was always years, as I recall, between books. I don't think it was ever 1 year between books that I can think of.
According to the progress bar on Brandon's website, you know, the work on Towers of Midnight has been stalled for a couple months now, and that's mainly due to some other projects that Brandon has had to finish as the deadlines for Way of Kings is very, very rapidly approaching. So there's a lot of stuff that he has been working on. So far, the progress bar on Towers of Midnight has been stalled at about 85% for a little while. You know, he will, of course, within his blog and in various other fashions, say that, yes, he is still working on it. Last I had, they were finishing up an early round edit part, you know, for a good chunk of the book, and he should be getting back to producing newer material, if he hasn't already by this point, relatively soon.
Awesome. It's just amazing. Familiar enough with the creative process to be completely in awe of Brandon's ability to discipline himself and stay on deadlines and just continue to put out the kind of work, the quality work that he's putting out on so many different projects. He's a rare and amazing individual. Well, let's break it down a little bit. Let's break it down. First of all, where do we think that Tarmogoyf is actually going to begin? What do you see as the opening? What do you think the opening blows of Tarmogoyf are going to be struck? Is the whole thing going to take place at Shael Ghul, or is it going to be spread around the known world in various different locations, culminating to one big to-do at the end? That's a couple of jumping off spots there.
Well, I think because of the way that The Lord of the Rings was written, I think we kind of expect to see all the armies of the Earth amassing and marching on Shelu Ghul. But although Archer did stay true to a lot of the common fantasy formulas, in recent books, he really has gone far afield of the original kind of Tolkien-esque plot that we had in the first couple of books. And so I don't think that we're going to see a large amassing of all the armies of the Earth marching on Shelu Ghul and having to fight through to the mountain and the boar and somehow. I don't see that happening. Mostly because we already have Lan gathering people and going to Tarwyn Gap to secure the gap. So we have a large military presence there that can't leave, and trying to get anyone else through. I mean, you can travel, yes, but you're trying to go through the Blight, and that would just be a pain. I don't know if they can get all of the armies of the Earth to Shelu Ghul. I'm not sure if there's enough channelers to open enough gateways, and you can't march them through the Blight. The way gates are out, so I don't know. I can't see it all happening up north. Obviously, there has to be some form of battle there, because Rand has to be there to leave his blood on the rocks. But beyond that, I don't know.
I have to rather agree with you. First of all, I don't think the vast majority of this battle is going to be, the arm-in-arms battle? I don't think it's going to be soldiers, necessarily, who are going to be winning this battle. I think it's going to be largely fought with the One Power. We have seen such a massive increase in the number of channelers available to the light side in particular that it beggars the imagination that that wouldn't be, you know, the mainstay of how the battle is going to be fought. But, you know, and obviously the dark side has no trouble gaining recruits. They've got plenty of people. I guess part of it will depend on how much Egwene's purge of the Black Aja will affect the ranks of the Dark One.
Yeah, I also, the only other issue with, you know, the March on Mordor approach is going to be that, honestly, Rand's going to, when you really logistically think about it, he's going to have to move, even if he's using every available Ajamon and Chandler to open gateways. That's how it's going to have to travel there, whatever army is being fought or is fighting, because otherwise they have to march through the Blight. Regardless of if they enter at Tarwyn's Gap, which is the most accessible place to enter the Blight, you know, save from that one place near Fal Moron, you know, you're going to have to go through actually quite a fair stretch of Blight before you can even reach Shael Ghul. I mean, we know they have to go through a little bit of it because I think it was one of Demandred's point of views, or one of the Forsaken, when they gatewayed to Shael Ghul, was the idea that you couldn't gate directly there. The One Power does weird things around Shael Ghul, and as a result, you had to kind of gate a little further off and then walk the rest of the way. So it's not going to just be there are gateways open and people rushing through directly onto the slopes of Shael Ghul. But at the same time, I really think it would be horrendously exciting but terribly boring at the same time to see, oh, look, we have this army of thousands of people and hundreds of channelers, and we're going to fight miles and miles and miles through the Blight in order to get to Shael Ghul.
Yeah, that could be a little tedious. And as you said, that, you know, it's sort of been done. Obviously, you have to go back to the grandfather of all fantasy, The Lord of the Rings. You know, where actually the real battle to get to the Blight was Frodo and Sam, and the armed troops, you know, issuing to the gates of Mordor was basically a big bluff designed to draw the enemy's attention away from the real attack. So I just can't see Robert Jordan or Brandon Sanderson following that same path. I think it's going to be something unique and original. I'm not an author, so I can't really conceive of how you could come up with something cooler than that, but I have no doubt that they will.
Going back to kind of our idea here, if I was given the opportunity to write it based on what I know now, the way I think I would have it laid out is, you would have the Battle of Tarwyn's Gap. You would have the Borderlanders actually be important where they are for some reason or another. There's some fight going on in the middle of Randland or something. But then you would have the Band of the Red Hand, the army that Perrin has, and whatever forces Rand have with him, those three forces would actually move up into Sheol Ghul, and then the battle there would be fought on three fronts. One is the Channeling Front, which is basically where Rand and his forces, and probably Egwene and other members of the White Tower, Egwene probably in Loghain, I don't know, but they would be kind of fighting the channeling battle. You would have the physical, which is obviously Matt, and then you would have Perrin. This one is really interesting because it has made some assumptions about what the Horn of Valyr does, but you would have Perrin fighting in Teleron An-Riad with the wolf spirit, the wolf brother spirit that exists there. And so you would have that epic battle going on in and around Sheol Ghul and other battles going on elsewhere. You would have Lan and those borderland peoples who followed him defending Tarwyn's Gap. You would have something, I don't even know what, that the borderlanders, just because there has to be some reason for Robert Jordan to have moved them into the middle of the continent. And also, I think I would have the Shido have to protect the Waste from an overrun of Trollocs, just so that they win back some of their lost honor. Because right now, in the Waste, there's not much there protecting it. If when the Aiel followed Rand out of the Threefold Land, they left the wives and or the women and children, and that was it, basically. Those who could not fight were left there. And so I think the fact that the Shido are going back to the Waste is a perfect shot for them to redeem themselves. And then maybe we have like a surge up from the Land of the Madmen, and so you have the Sea Folk defending the high seas from Madmen coming from the south. Shaunchan maybe helping out there. I don't know. It could get really interesting. If I was allowed to write it, will that actually happen? Probably not. Because I'm not that imaginative, and I just think, kill things and blow stuff up, and it's cool. Robert Jordan and Brandon Sandersons are much better craftsmen and much better artists than I am. And so what Robert Jordan came up with and what Brandon will eventually get out to us is going to be much better than what I come up with.
You know, for some reason, I was just thinking about this. I was kind of focusing on, for the moment, on the battle at Tarwyn's Gap. And there's a lot of course, cyclic nature in these novels. Brandon, I've recently been reading through the annotations for the Mistborn books, and Brandon himself is a big proponent of bringing things somewhat full circle, whereas certain ideas will come back and not always necessarily happen the exact same way, but have a similar vein to them. And I'm just minded of two very important things. The first one being that the nation of Malkir is being overrun. They called for help, and, you know, help was just too late in arriving. And the second thing that I'm minded of is that story from Eye of the World, where, you know, the king of Manethrin, you know, in order to save the people, you know, fights off, you know, the Trolloc hordes for days past when all hope should have been lost of them being able to survive. And the common people of Manethrin came forward and gave up their lives as well in order to assure that a bulk of Manethrin's people could escape, you know, thereby giving Emmonsfield its name.
What?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because Aemon died, and it became Aemon's Field, and Aemon's Field loosely translated over time becomes Emmon's Field.
Yeah, I understand now. I was thinking Malkyri instead of Manethrin.
Oh, gotcha.
But the idea is that there wasn't help when help was needed, even from the allies, even from Manethrin, and they were still able to do great things and hold off the Dark One. And I see the battle at Tarwyn's Gap being that. We have the Malkyri, once again, have completely amassed. They're going to be fighting a battle. They're going to be losing. It's going to be desperate. We have the common people, who we saw from the beginning of the prologue, Gathering Storm, arriving, and also, you know, not just having that passive role of, well, I'm gonna blacksmith for the army and that, but also, you know, like the man does in the prologue, you know, turning his best scythe into a pole arm and actually going in and fighting, you know, even though he has no skill. But this time I actually see the other nations, the borderland army that should be in the Blight anyway, instead actually making that last minute, you know, Ride of the Rohirrim kind of, you know, they do show up this time. You know, it comes full circle, but at this time there is help. You know, the White Tower, I mean, I'm going to guess if the White Tower shows up to aid Malkier in the fight at the Gap, it's going to be because of Nynaeve. You know, she, you know, in this case, you know, the spirit of Eldraine, rather than lashing out in grief, is arriving with support out of sheer frustration. And I actually see the battle turning and actually being a victory for the Light without its tragic consequences, so that the wheel can come full circle, but not necessarily repeat the same pattern. And it's just something that kind of struck me as I'm sitting here, or now pacing back and forth in the room that I'm speaking from.
Well, I like that you said that. I actually have always had a sneaking suspicion, since it seems that so many of our characters are at least hinted at, that they might be some famous character from the past reborn, especially the Emmons Fielders. I have often wondered if Nynaeve was not the direct lineal descendant, the possible rebirth of Eldraine? I can't remember the name now.
I've already said Eldraine, but that's probably...
Eldraine.
Well, also...
The Queen of the Netherlands,
Also, though, it would come in circle with Malkyrie, too, not just Manethrin. Because when you think about it, Malkyrie, we learn in the New Spring that they called for help from the White Tower, and the White Tower didn't get there in time, and so they just pretended like they had never sent help or never received a call or something. And so for the White Tower to come and basically rescue the heir, the king of Malkyrie, the uncrowned king of Malkyrie, I think would also create a great circle, like you're talking about, the closure that is needed there.
Well, I think some of this falls under the category of what Brandon was talking about in his interview. He's talked about it a couple of times, but he mentioned it in his interview with us. And he was specifically referring, I believe, at the time to Rand and his meeting with Tam, that there are certain things that an author implies so strongly that he builds up what is called narrative debt to the reader. In other words, you're throwing out there that this is going to happen, or some resolution to this conflict is going to occur, or some interaction between some characters is going to happen at some point in time. And if you don't do it, you have basically abrogated your debt to the reader by leading them on. You know, it's one thing to do a red herring. It's another thing to sit there for, as Robert Jordan has done, book after book after book, leading up to, or apparently obviously leading up to some certain event, and then never having it happen. And I think some of these plotline resolutions with the Malkyrie and Nynaeve and Egwene and some of the others probably, if not certainly, fall into that sort of category. And I know that Brandon is very sensitive to that because he brought it up. So I'm sure that some of these things are going to happen, and it would kind of make a nice little package. But on the other hand, having read some of Brandon's other book and knowing how, if you'll forgive the Wheel of Time, Lord of the Rings crossover, knowing how tricksy Robert Jordan was, they may do something just totally different just to confound us all. Hey, Robert Jordan made Gollum look like a straight, upstanding, plain, vanilla-born citizen when it came to Trixie, because he is the master of, well, at least for me, maybe I'm just not clever enough to see it, but there are so many times when I thought something was going to come down a certain way, and then the book comes out and I go, oh my God, he got me again. Oh, you know, didn't see that coming, but that's a good writer for you.
Yeah, they do that, but still, it still fulfills the promise that they've made.
Just not how we think.
They come out with these things that we aren't expecting at all, but still, it fulfills the promise that we have, that they made to us, that needed to be fulfilled.
Trixie, though.
Right.
I think the one thing I can say about all this is that it's not going to resemble Lord of the Rings in any way. I feel confident that Robert Jordan would have gone out of his way not to have that happen, and I expect probably the same with Brandon. I mean, there may be similarities because it is a fantasy epic, and certain things have to happen. based on what's built up so far. But on the other hand, I truly, firmly believe that it will be something that none of us have really foreseen. I know we're good, and we probably discuss this more than anybody else around, except maybe Alan and Maria and Harriet. But I fully expect there'll be a lot of surprises in store for us. I wish I could credit for picking out the answers sometimes, but
yeah,
I'm just wondering how he's going to resolve the dichotomy or the tension between the two powerful forces for both the light and the dark. I mean, we're shaping up with two halves of a big battle, one involving, you know, the force of arms, you know, men, swords, horses, you know, the traditional medieval type army with traditional weapons. And then we have the enormous, now enormously swollen ranks of the superpowers, you know, the channelers who can perform basically magic miracles, however you want to put it, when it's compared to a guy swinging a sword. So I don't know how they're going to resolve the tension between that, because in my mind, if you leave it all up to the channelers, it's just too easy. You know, it's just too easy to resolve it with the one power. If you leave it up to the armies and don't make enough use of the channelers, then somebody's going to go, well, why didn't they do that? I would have done that. And I have to confess, there have been a number of times, particularly with the three girls and a few times with Rand, where I thought to myself, why didn't he just do that? Why didn't he just channel to resolve that? You know, and the one that particularly comes to my mind, and I guess a lot of people have written it off to the fact that the girls are basically novices and just don't think about using the power one time, but I can guarantee it would have occurred to me when they're stranded in the boat on the way to Tyr, it runs up on the sandbar, they get off and start traipsing around the countryside. You know, why didn't they just use the one power and shove the boat off the sandbar? That wouldn't have been hard for any one of those girls. But then again, you know, they needed to be off the boat. They needed to be where they were so that they could meet Avienda and Luark and, you know, the Aiel and have all these other various adventures. But still in all, it always, always bothered me intensely that not one of those three smart cookies thought about using the power to get that boat off the sandbar. And I don't want to see stuff like that happening in the last battle. I don't want to walk away thinking, well, why did they do that? They could have just, there'll need to be some good reasons why the channelers just don't resolve everything in about 32 seconds.
Because there's channelers on the other side that are trying to keep the channelers on, the channelers on either side have the ability to cancel the other squeeze. And I think that especially with the Dreadlord training grounds that the Black Tower has turned into, there's going to be a heavy force of channelers for the Dark Ones, for the Dark Side, the evil Dark Friend people. There's going to be lots of bad guys that can channel, and so they're going to be able to effectively cancel a lot of what our good side Light Friend peoples can throw at them, and vice versa. I think our side might have the advantage in that we have more Saiangriel, Angriel, Terangriel, and we are more likely to be willing to work together in links. I say we, even though I have no actual part in this, they are more willing to actually be willing to work together in circles and get linked together. Whereas, because of the selfishness of the Dark Friends, I'm not sure that they would be able to. And we know that they don't have as many Angriel, Terangriel, Saangriel, and especially as Egwene is now making sure that she guards the ones in the White Tower. I'm not sure if we ever found out what happened to the stash, the stuff that was taken out of Rupidian. I think it's still in Carpian. Elaine, I have to assume, keeps a pretty good eye on the stash that she got out of Nidudar. Those are the only ones we really know about. So I have to assume that they won't be able to get their hands on many more powerful objects of the power. So we will have the advantage there, but I think they might have the advantage in pure numbers of channelers.
Yeah, I agree with that. I actually think that's where the balance happens, is that in sheer numbers and overwhelming amount of individual channelers, the forces of the Dark One are going to have an advantage, but the side on Rand and the side of the Light, we're going to have, our channelers are going to have the advantage of firepower. Unless, you know, they've been secreting them away and, you know, that we, you know, come out with the shocker, oh, they're channeling using Saangriel too. And, you know, in which case then it really becomes, you know, a storm of chaos. Then, yeah, I definitely think that that's that's our balancing force, is that the White Tower is better equipped, whereas the forces of the Dark One are going to be a flood of individuals. They're going to zerg us.
Now we have a Star Trek reference. This is great. I love it.
And Taro all four.
Anyway, well, how do you think the Shonchan are going to play into all this?
I don't know.
You think Carmen Guyton is going to be partly happening in Shonchan or even in Shandar, or are they going to bring the fight? They're going to bring the fight to Wanland.
I'm pretty sure the fight is going to be mostly in the continent that the story has been set in, simply because the Shonchan know nothing of Trollocs, and if the Dark One. And their forces were able to attack Shonchan, they would have. And so the Shonchan would know of Trollocs and that. Whereas they were reintroduced to them in the Gathering Storm when Ali Kiergan made the deal with Perrin, ran into a group of them and almost got killed. Shonchan, what they're going to do? I honestly don't know, because I don't see how the whole resolution with the Shonchan are trying to invade, the people of Randland are trying to not let them, and they're all going to be killed by the Dark One. I don't see... There has to be some form of parley between the Shonchan and the leaders, the rulers of Randland, all of whom currently wear some form of fealty to Rand or have some form of connection to him, except maybe the Borderlanders. So I don't know what you still have. I mean, maybe with the Tohrakan and their ability to drop troops like they did on Tar Valon, they might be able to fly right over the Blight and take troops into the Blasted Lands. But anyway, they might be able to, with the Tohrakan, fly troops directly beyond the Blight over the mountain, maybe not over the Mountains of Doom. I don't know how high those peaks are, but directly into the Blasted Lands and Chaos Ghul.
That would be weird.
Yeah, and it's a possibility. I'm not sure if it's a probability, though. I mean, I can't see them traveling because they're so distrusting of anything concerning the One Power except properly leashed. Well, maybe if they had a properly leashed Damani creating the gateway, then they would be able to travel. I'm not sure that they'll be able to do it immediately, that they'll be able to get over their bias immediately enough to do it, even though they do have Elida now, and we know that Elida will... We have to assume that Elida will be instrumental in teaching them how to travel. I'm not sure that they'll be able to get over there. But the actual main population of the Shonchan, maybe not so much. So I'm not sure how much use they'll be. We do know that the Trollocs are using the Ways, although Rand does have does have the Ogier going around, and Elder Hoffin, and I'm not sure if, I'm pretty sure Loyal is going to the Grand Great Stump, rather than continuing to try and find Waygates and close them, but I'm pretty sure that didn't Elder Haemon take over the responsibility of closing all the Waygates?
I think Haemon said that he would take up getting the last of them closed so that Loyal could go and speak at the stump. I think that was something that he had said to Rand at some point during either Knife of Dreams would have to have been in Knife of Dreams.
So many military factions that it's hard to figure out what all of them are going to do. I don't believe that we're going to see them all around Shae'ul Ghul and besieging the Boar. I think there's no way, the logistics of getting them all there is just not possible. So you've got the entire Shonchan army, they have to be doing something. You've got the entire Borderland army, they probably will end up in Tarwin's Gap. But you've also got all the Aiel, what are they going to be doing? You've got Roldan Littoralda, he's in the Borderlands trying to keep the Blight at bay. You've got the Sea Folk, they've got something. I don't even know what they're supposed to be doing. The White Tower could either go with Rand or could go to Tarwin's Gap. The Black Tower, same thing. Those members of the Black Tower that are still through the light and aren't dark friends. There's just way too different actions. And not to mention all the different militaries of the different nations that are not related to one another at all.
Really, the logistics of this are just a nightmare, really.
It's like a chess set, only the chessboard isn't laid out in nice, cute squares. And no one knows exactly how all the pieces are supposed to move.
And what was really kind of amazing to me is that now we've got all these new minor characters wending their way to the last battle, too, like Renaud, what is his name, in the very beginning of the Gathering Storm, the farmer. Yeah. Taking off, you know, with his neighbors to go fight. Now we got even more people in the mix. I was really kind of shocked that new characters were still being introduced. I guess you have to do it. I really thought that the last two books would be, or three books really, would be more of a putting down of processes and people and, you know, plot lines. It was, to a certain extent.
Well, yeah, there are plot lines that are ending, but there's also everything is boiling and about to come to this peak because we are approaching Tarmogoyon. And so I really love that first point of view in the prologue from Renaud Sanwar because it's just so powerful. The emotional picture that it paints is absolutely amazing. Well, and it's like we said earlier, it's really just a question of numbers. It's a whole numbers game. Because although we've been dwelling on them a lot, and so we've seen them a lot in the book, I don't think that there's that big a number of dark friends in the world at all. And I don't think, well, maybe there's a large number of Trollocs and Halfmen, maybe. But I think that the side of the light just has so many people that they can throw at this, march nobly into battle, that they can use. The bad guys might have more channelers, but the good guys have more people.
Well, but you don't you think that the actual advent of Tarmogoyon is going to bring a lot of the wannabes and borderline dark friends out of the shadows, as it were? I almost said closet, but out of the shadows to take sides at last.
Yes, they will, but I still don't think that there's going to be that many of them. Maybe a few more than there would have been at the beginning of the series because they've seen all these things that are very tangible effects that you can attribute to the Dark One and have been attributed to the Dark One, even though we're pretty darn sure that it was Rand's own mental invisibility. But still, they've seen all these things that they assume to be the importance of the Dark One and the powers of the Dark One. And so the Dark One's power is very real in their lives, whereas the power of their creator is much more subtle. And so they don't really see it. They don't, I hate to get religious on you, but it's like now we don't see and rejoice in the miracle that is life, that is creation. We look at all the bad stuff and say, why is there this? Why does evil have so much power, rather than looking at all the good stuff we have and saying, look at how much power there is in the good.
Well, they mistake subtlety for weakness, unfortunately, a lot of times.
Well, and I think that's true, but I think it's more that there's just so much everyday things that you see every day, or at least once a year. You see the trees budding, you see new grass, you see new water. Or even in the fall when you see things start to decay and die, but to bring forth new life. All of this stuff, it's a miracle of creation. And the fact that we can look past it and say, yes, but this person and this person are so apparently evil that evil has to be stronger. No, it doesn't. It isn't. Life and goodness are much stronger than any evil will ever be, simply because they are more prevalent. They're just also, but because they're more prevalent, they're more overlooked.
Well, I sort of had a thought there, and it kind of escaped me a little bit. There's an old theological argument that evil is not the opposite of good, it's the absence of good. Darkness isn't the opposite of light, it's the absence of light. And if that's true, then it's almost a foregone conclusion that the light would have to win because evil isn't actually really anything tangible in and of itself. It's an absence of what should be rather than, but in a way that sort of follows with what Ron wrote in the very beginning, that the Dark One wanted to kill the Wheel of Time, blind the eye of the world, and cause time itself to stop, which would be the ultimate absence of everything.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that cause the evil ones to be no longer existing, too? I don't understand how the Dark One expects to survive.
I don't think we fully comprehend the Dark One and the Creator that Robert Jordan has created, that he has created for his world. And You know, we don't want to go too far into theology in our own world just because there are so many different and sometimes conflicting, sometimes not, viewpoints. But in Robert Jordan's world, there is a very tangible, very real dark one and power of this creation. And it's not the absence of creation. It is its own entity that actively seeks to destroy. And
yeah, exactly.
I don't know what his ultimate goal is. We assume, based on what Ishmael has proposed in this series, that his ultimate goal is the end of everything, including Ishmael and the dark and all the chosen and the forsaken. They think that he's going to take down the Creator and set up this glorious world of chaos where they get to lead as commanders. That's not what we've been led to believe is going to happen. What we've been led to believe is going to happen if the Dark One wins is the end of everything, the complete destruction of the pattern and the world as it is entirely, and so no more chosen to rule anything because there's nothing to rule and there's no chosen to rule them.
But that, you know, if that's true, then what's always bothered me is that if that were really true, then why wouldn't the Dark One advocate the unbridled use of Balefire nonstop 24/7 by his minions, because that would cause the end of everything quicker than almost anything we know of, without him even having to break out of his prison or anything else?
Well, I mean, part of that, an answer, and it's the best answer I can give, and as Morden was mentioning in his conversation with Rand, you know, where he divulges the idea that, you know, the other Forsaken don't understand what they're really, really fighting for, and that, you know, the Dark One is looking to destroy everything. I don't see it as being instantaneous. I think there is a satisfaction for the Dark One in reshaping the world to its choosing, and in doing so, number one, it takes time to exert, you know, even on a planetary scale, you know, that sort of reworking of existence. But at the same time, I don't necessarily think it's a complete oblivion that the Dark One is actually trying to achieve. I think it is a level of destruction that we would think of as being oblivion, but that existence itself is somehow preserved enough. Again, if for some reason, I see the Dark One as being the entity to gloat. Ha ha, look, you may have created everything, but I still destroyed it. Kind of, you know, existence. Like, this duality with the Creator is something that there has to be a measure of, because I'm the Dark One, because I am evil, per se, I have to have not only the last word, but I also have to have the last laugh, the best laugh, the loudest laugh, and you have to acknowledge that you have been defeated by me. And if it were just, oh, your champion's dead, I broke the wheel, you know, time itself has unraveled completely, there wouldn't be anything left for him to say, ha, look, I am triumphant, ha ha!
Destroyed the world, destroyed the universe, killed time, that's a wrap, moving on.
At this moment, podcasters begin to discuss Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn series. If you happen to be reading through this series, please fast forward the podcast about somewhere between 2.5 to 5 minutes ahead. We'll be done talking about it by then, but we do spoil something extremely, extremely important, and we would really feel bad if anyone actually managed to you know, be spoiled by that particular thing. Thank you.
You know, I could be wrong. It's kind of weird to think about, but I kind of equate the Dark One similar to the deity in Branded Mistborn trilogy, Ruin. His ultimate goal is the destruction of everything, and so he and in the Mistborn, Ruin and Preservation got together and they made a deal. Ruin would help Preservation create this thing because he couldn't create it by himself, with the understanding that at the end of the time, Ruin would get the opportunity to destroy it all. And so
Preservation cheated.
Yeah, and Preservation cheated. And,
yeah, but everybody died anyway. The whole world ended and everybody died anyway.
They didn't.
Well, pretty much. I was...
Ben died and Ellen died, and if you're listening to this and you haven't...
Everybody
before,
important.
I'm sorry.
Everybody important. How's that?
Hey, snow. Sunshine didn't die. Spook didn't die. In fact, of the original group of thieves, it's really only Kelsey, Vin, and Ellen wasn't really part of the original group, but really only Kelsey and Vin that died. Really, after reading this one, I thought that would be the perfect ending to the Wheel of Time.
No.
And the idea that the powers of the Creator and the Dark One are both infused into Rand, and he becomes a new god. If that is true, because Brandon wrote the Mistborn trilogy before he started working on Wheel of Time, that would be one of the freakiest coincidences in the history of literary art. But I don't think it is. However, I do sort of equate the Dark One and Ruin as the same thing. Their ultimate goal is the destruction of things, just because they like to destroy. I'm not sure if it's so much so that he can gloat, although that is those character traits that you brought up, Andrew, is possible, but they really are quite possible, and a good theory, and there's really no bad theories, I guess. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say yes, maybe, without insulting you. I'm not sure that we want to do any more on guessing what's going to happen during Tommen Gaidon, simply because we can guess and postulate. I think we'd be repeating ourselves over and over again. You know, we don't have, with the breakneck pace that Brandon has set himself, we really, 2 years isn't that long to wait to see the conclusion of this. We only have a few more months until the next book comes out, until we see Towers of Midnight. And after that, it's only going to be about a year until we see A Memory of Light. And when you compare that to the wait that we've had between other novels, I say we, although I really haven't had to endure it as much as some of the rest of the fans have been fans since 1990. I've only been a fan since, so.
It's been 20 years. It's been 20 years since the first book, I believe. So I think we've waited plenty long enough and paid our dues. But the only thing I want to say in closing is that I just, and I can't see how it will be, but I do not want to see the last battle resolved in four paragraphs like Robert Jordan did with Aram. He's in book after book after book. He's trailing around after pair. He's doing all these things, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, you're dead. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
If they wrap up the last battle like that, I'm going to be sorely unamused.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, too, we can close this topic out for right now, but we're going to come back to it. Everybody knows realistically that the topic of Tommen Gaidon and our various ideas and theories on what's going to happen is going to resurface again. It's just a natural part of talking about a series of this length is our speculation on what's going to happen, not just next, but how it's all going to come to a head. So we will not be leaving this topic lightly, because we know we'll be back to it before long.
Yeah. And we may not have an actual episode that we title and devote and say, yes, we're going to be talking about Tommen Gaidon. We're going to be talking about Tommen Gaidon this time, and that's what we're going to be talking about. But we will bring it up again in the course of our other topics, just because everything eventually points to Tommen Gaidon, and it is going to be important. And so we'll spend a lot of time talking about it, no matter what the reason for it. No matter what the actual topic is we're supposed to be talking on.
Yeah, it'll be hard to avoid it, because it's an integral part of the end of the book. Last battle and the last book, they sort of go together. I don't know what I'm going to do, actually, when the last book actually comes. I mean, on the one hand, I can't wait, but on the other hand, it's going to leave a big hole. Not waiting for more. You know what I mean? Not having any more books forthcoming, or at least that we know of for sure.
Yeah.
There's still some possibilities on the table, but Brandon hasn't held out a lot of hope that there are going to be any of the Outrigger novels or, you know, other books published. It's a possibility, but right now I think they're leaning not. They'll probably do the encyclopedia, you know, the appendix, or what do you want to call it?
On kind of a side note, I do want to kind of announce over the podcast, you know, we've been using Encyclopedia Watt, and it is a great resource, but there are a whole lot of other a whole lot of other fan sites out there that just have so much information. There is a new website called Wheel of Time Database. The URL is www.wotdb, that's WOTDB.com. And let me read a bit from their about page. It says, "Welcome. Thank you so much for your interest in this website. I strive to create an enjoyable user experience and a fast, accurate way to search and find all of your Wheel of Time needs. If you're an avid reader of the Wheel of Time, you must know that there are over 1,000 characters with dozens of nationalities, classes, and factions. And you also know that when a new book comes out, it's imperative that we reread all the prior books to catch up. After all, very few of us, if any, can remember it all. However, I found myself reading through book 7 or book 8, and I saw a name, I forget which one, and I thought to myself, who the heck is that? I searched around the internet and found some fantastic resources, such as Encyclopedia Watt, DragonMount.com, and many other resources. It took about 20 clicks, but I found what I was looking for, and then some. The only thing that bugged me was the lack of a true centralized searchable database. I wanted a way to find out information about characters quickly and accurately, and thus the site was born. I compiled all of the data I could find into a MySQL database. This kind of database is known as a relational database, which essentially means that I can cross-reference data pretty quickly. In other words, nearly every single page on this website, with the exception of the About page and the Contacts page, is generated on the fly from the database. First of all, it allows for simple changes to the website without altering the data. The hint that allows me to update the data in one place and then change the
propagate
across the entire website. And finally, it allowed me to build a search engine to crawl through this massive amount of data, over 1,400 characters, and find whatever it is I'm searching for. The engine isn't perfect, but I'm continually tweaking it to make it better and better. So why should you come here instead of Encyclopedia Watt or Dragon Mount? Well, I'll be honest with you, you shouldn't. The site is for a specific purpose, finding character-related data quickly and accurately. Personally, I visit both of those sites on a pretty regular basis, even with this site built. My goal isn't to replace either of those sites, nor do I want them to be put out of business. No, what I intend is for this site to be a complement to the others, an accessory to improving the vast knowledge of the Wheel of Time. What I want you, the user, to get out of this site is the ability to find answers to questions that you don't already know. Need an example? Ask yourself this. How many dead Aes Sedai are from Andor? Go ahead, think about it for a second. I'll wait. No idea? 10, maybe? Well, a quick click at the top of the page for dead Aes Sedai Andor will spit out the results. Pretty neat, huh? I hope you enjoy this Wheel of Time database. The site is the culmination of months of effort, and I sincerely hope you'll find it useful. As always, I expect comments, suggestions, and corrections from the contact page. Regards, Camel. Don't know who Camel is, but this is going to be a wonderful tool because a lot of times all the information we have is, yeah, this was this one lady from this one place who died, and so just having the ability to search for what we know rather than having to figure out a little bit more in order to go into Encyclopedia Watt. Because Encyclopedia is a great resource, but like you said, there's just some things that aren't quite easily searchable in it. And so to have this database is going to be a great resource. And so I want to announce on the podcast that it is available. Again, the address is www.wattdb.com.
Well, that'll wrap up this discussion of Tarmon Gaiden for this episode. As Spencer said, we may revisit this again, and surely will, in passing at least. And again, I appreciate you guys coming on. It's always fun. I'm glad you guys were able to. I'm glad we're all able to get together and talk about the Wheel of Time because, you know, we love this. It's so much fun.
If you have any ideas, criticisms, or feedback, there are a number of ways you can get a hold of us here at the Fourth Age. You, of course, can call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
You can always email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. We'd read every email, and usually you'll get a response from one or more of us, you know, within, at least a day, sometimes within mere moments. I happen to be looking at my phone.
Also, you can find us on dragonmount.com. They're our host site, and you can find us at dragonmount.com/podcast, where you can find an archive of all the episodes that we've done, and after each episode, there is a comment section. And you can leave your comments there, and there's always a couple of us that are going through, and we're replying to you on there. Also, at forums.dragonmount.com, there is a forum dedicated to the fourth age, and it doesn't get as much traffic as the actual podcast page. I think mostly because a lot of people aren't sure it's there, or I'm not sure if you use the forums or not, but it is there, and please feel free to use it. We are also available there, and we are, I at least, am active on the forum there.
Additionally, you can follow both Fourth Age and our host site, Dragonmount, on Twitter. And additionally, both Dragonmount and the Fourth Age have Facebook groups as well. You can find us by searching for either Dragonmount or the Fourth Age.
And now that we've given you all the ways that you can leave us feedback, you probably have noticed over the course of this episode that the sound quality from Virginia and Andrew, and probably from myself too, is a little bit different from what you're used to. This is because we're trying a different way of actually recording a podcast. Hopefully it'll be more convenient. We're not sure yet about just how we're going to use this. We want you to let us know what you think about it. But beyond the fact that Virginia and Andrew sound like they're talking on telephones, I don't know what I sound like. I can't hear myself. But we do want your feedback on the sound quality, just the quality of this episode in general. And we will use that feedback to kind of help us figure out what way we're going to be going in the future.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We're constantly trying to improve the podcast in any way that we can and also facilitate all of us getting together because we are not all in the same area. We're spread across the country in different time zones and have varying computer capabilities and bandwidth availability. And so it gets to be a little problematic sometimes. So I'm not sure that the quality of this phone recording will be adequate, but we're going to give it a try and hope for the best. So please be patient with us while we're working on this little technical issue here. In any case, we always do welcome, as Spencer said, we always do welcome your feedback. We love to hear from you if you have any ideas or suggestions. We are considering bringing back some of the departments that the original podcast crew had, Crazy Theories, What You Should Know, and I personally would welcome suggestions if you have any for anything like that you might like to see us do. I can't guarantee that we will, but we certainly are open to all suggestions and all possibilities. So this is your podcast as well as ours, and we want to make it something that you enjoy listening to, because we're glad you're here, and we're glad that you come along for the ride to enjoy this incredible series and talk about it the way we do. So thanks. This is Virginia once again thanking you for joining us, and thank you, Andrew and Spencer, for joining me tonight.
And I want to say thank you to Andrew and Virginia for letting me be a part of this. I want to thank all the listeners for your continuing support of the podcast in spite of the technical trials and mishaps that we go through. May you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravya Tento Manchima, Saishite.
These things, which are outside of the podcast topic that Andrew wonders about, that would be removed because he just sounds like a babbling idiot.
Actually, I think they're good points. I don't always remove them.
Well, no. Sometimes my ramblings go someplace, and I'm fine with not sounding right all the time. It's just like, for some reason, it's like when I can't even make up my own mind during a sentence, it's like, yeah, that's probably a point where it's just better left not there.